The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt. Our colleague Noel is not here today, but will rejoin us shortly.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul, Mission Control, Deck, and most importantly, you are here. That makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. Matt, would you say, do you have houseplants?
No, I have zero houseplants. I have plants that live in the backyard.
I got some houseplants too. I sometimes verge into prepper territory. So it's like whenever I have green onions, I decide I have to plant them. We know our pal codenamed Doc Holliday is quite the enthusiast of houseplants, right?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I'm so nervous about fungus these days. I'm nervous about the types of plants that grow around me in case that fungus wants to hang out with those plants.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe just mutate, which fungus does all the time. Oh, man. We've been on a bit of a plant kick here at the studios of late. We talked about photosynthesis, to whether plants are intelligent. And to your point, Matt, no spoilers, but we have a fascinating episode about fungus on the way. And tonight we're veering into somewhat philosophical territory. What exactly is the human-plant relationship? I think most of us, even if you have a green thumb or if you feel like plants just die in a 3-meter radius of you, I think we all kind of have some assumptions about humans and their relationship to plants. Would you say that's fair?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This whole episode, can I do a quick shout out to Malcolm X?
Always.
In my mind, this episode is, we did not domesticate these figs. These figs domesticated us.
Said to the tone of, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock.
Yeah, that's it.
That's beautiful. Here are the facts. Folks, check out our photosynthesis episode for the basics of plant life, wherein you can hear Matt and I and Noel expounding about just how strange and amazing photosynthesis is. It's a superpower. It's massively underrated. It is, in a very real way, the engine upon which most of the natural world runs. And I don't know about you, man, but since we recorded that episode, I walk by plants and sometimes just stare at them now.
Yeah, there are some particular vines in my backyard, I guess, that were planted there by the previous homeowner. And I often watch them, thinking that I am seeing them do their little movement that's kind of a circular motion, like trying to wrap around something. I know in my mind that's probably just the wind moving them, but I imagine them being sentient and able to move in real time, or at least the time that I experience, right, in seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. You can also see plants responding to sunlight, right, tracking the movement of the sun. That's amazing. And both of those examples kind of show us that humans have a lot of incorrect assumptions about plants. You know, they're not all created equal. We talked about that a little bit. Some are super adaptable. Others can only exist in a very specific set of circumstances. And it's kind of like, it reminds me of how amphibians are often the first life forms to go when an ecosystem starts changing, because they rely on a balance of a water system and a land system.
Yeah, get the temperature or moisture off by just a little bit and they get wiped out.
Same reason, honestly, it's one of the main reasons I've never had a pet octopus, because those guys are so tough to keep alive in a...
keep in cages or whatever you keep it in.
right. Yeah. And the other reason, of course, being their abbreviated lifespans.
Yeah. And their ability to understand that they're alive, we think.
Right. The fact that an octopus can dream. If you are interested in going down a bit of a rabbit hole or a cephalopod hole, then after tonight's show, folks, go to your browser of choice and search for footage of octopuses dreaming. I kid you not, it's amazing, because their chromatophores respond to whatever they're experiencing in the dream.
Dude. I watch my dog's dream, and it's mostly just like, but they're definitely chasing something.
Mm-hmm. I watch my cat's dream, and maybe because they are getting up there in the years, their dreams seem to be apparently complex. You know, I don't know if this happens with dogs. We know it happens with people. Have you ever been in a situation, Matt, where someone wakes up from a dream? And in the dream, their dream version of you did something, and they kind of like low key hold you responsible. That happens to me.
I've done that to people in my life where I have a weird dream about you, whoever you are. And then I side eye you a little bit more in my waking times. But because look, I'm definitely guilty of that. But there's a weird thing where sometimes, just depending on how your dreams are functioning that particular night, it's like you're putting stuff together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, defragging the system, we called it. And some great inventions and discoveries are arrived at in dreams. Like I've woken up before, had the answer to a story. Great mathematicians have, you know what, we're getting off topic, but this is fascinating stuff. And I bring up the line between wake and sleep just because, dude, again, off topic. I'm pretty convinced one time recently, one of my cats had a dream and something bad happened in the dream. And when it woke up, it was pissed at me because the dream Ben had done something. And I don't know how to navigate that situation.
Well, it remembered that time that you asked it very quietly and gently to be quiet while we're recording. And it was like, who is this guy?
Where does tell he me get off?
This big cat that I live with that wears hats sometimes telling me that I can't do this.
Yeah.
Because don't cats see other humans as cats, like as part of their pride or whatever?
Yeah, similar to the way dogs see other animals as part of their pack.
Exactly. You know?
And that's that also may be a result of domestication, right? We have as a civilization, we have domesticated not just animals, but plants. And we don't talk about that too often, right? Outside of staple grains.
It's weird to think about. We think about developing the arts of farming, right? All the skills and the tools necessary and the techniques. But we don't think about it as actually taking plants and taking care of them, domesticating them to where they can live amongst us or near us, to where we have access to them all the time. Being very careful to make sure the temperatures they experience are not too hot or too cold, right? It is domestication.
It's true, man. And getting the right pH balance for the soil, pairing them with other plant life forms like the three sisters of the great Native American agriculturalist. Like the thing that's nuts to me is that we so often use the term domestication in a way that comes with a lot of baggage, right? Because you think of like wild animals versus domesticated animals. So was corn out there just raising hell, drinking every night, you know, skydiving? Yeah. And someone was like, hey, you got to commit. Calm down.
You need to grow roots. But there is, I think with the term domestication, there is maybe an image conjured in my mind, at least, of training something to be comfortable in a certain environment, which weirdly does apply to taking these plants that grow in the wild and putting them in a brand new environment, getting them used to that and growing well with all those different factors you just mentioned.
Yeah. And if we look back at the history of this, experts believe that people began domesticating plants around 10,000 to 12,000 years ago. Currently, the going bet is that this occurred all over the world at different times in different cultures, but it occurred first probably in the Tigris and Euphrates River, in what would be part of modern day Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. And it's nuts because there's some Sherlock Holmes stuff about this. There's a little bit of MacGyver about this. You know, cast your memory back. We're old, very early humans, and we know that you can eat some things. We know you can't eat other things because, you know, Uncle Gilgamesh died, right?
Mm-hmm.
Getting too big for his britches with some mushrooms. And so we start collecting these seeds, and then we do exactly what you're describing, Matt. We say, okay, let's make sure these little guys have some water. Let's make sure we put them through a process of trial and error, I imagine. Let's make sure we put them in a place where they are most likely to grow abundantly.
Well, yeah, and that's all trial and error too, unless you observe them, those plants in the wild growing with partial sunlight or full sunlight or, you know, in the shade, which, you know, you're kind of rolling the dice. But once you figure it out, you can, if you've got a writing system, you can write that down, and everybody who gets access to that information has it. It really is a technology in all its forms. I guess it's not really. Could that be a weapon? I guess it could, because
yes,
you could grow the wrong kinds of plants that can hurt people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You can grow plants that hurt people. You could grow or deploy invasive species that damage another crop or wildlife. And people have done those things. People figure stuff out, you know, and we're never going to know which individuals, again, across the world, separated by chasms of space and time, we'll never know which ones figured out this little hack, but the world owes them a great debt. These anonymous pioneers are the reason we can do a podcast right now.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. That's why cities are a thing. Congratulations.
Yes. Yeah. We'd still be hunting and gathering, right? and there's nothing wrong with that. The first domesticated plants, we imagine, if we're looking at the Mesopotamian record, were things like wheat, barley, lentils, and surprisingly, types of peas. I don't know much about peas.
Oh, I hope they're English peas. They're some of my favorite things on the planet.
I'll tell you, you know, I still, every time I'm in a grocery store, and I love the I love the weird vibes of grocery stores, the one can in the vegetable aisle that always stands out to me is that silver foiled peas can, because it sounds kind of creepy. They're like, very tender, very young, very sweet peas.
Oh, God, sounds good.
it sounds like there's a creepy French guy in a trench coat who is whispering to me in aisle 13. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if you get some paneer and just like a little bit of cream, maybe some spices, put all that together with those young whatever peas. Dang.
Very sweet, very young. And we were talking a little bit off air about different like staple grains. I go through a lentil phase every so often. And Matt, do you have a go-to like grain or cereal that you find yourself returning to?
It's rice for me. Just some steamed rice, some day-old rice. Throw it in an egg and a little bit of butter in a pan, or you know, oil in a pan. Just go for it. Maybe some tinned vegetables like peas and carrots and things like that. Good to go.
I love a good rice bowl too. It's so easy, man. Ah, rice.
That's why
good.
I like it. I'm not good at anything else. There's this this really delicious, I think it's Japanese barbecue sauce that you can find now at many places, at least in Georgia. Hopefully you can find it other places. I can't recall the name of it, but just a little bit of that on top of that rice as it's cooking. Hoo-hoo-hoo, baby.
It's all about the seasonings, right? And the sauces. Throw some, what do you call it, furikake on there and stuff. You're good to go, man.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's, dude, I'm going to get you some, or you got to try it if you find it. It's kind of an all-purpose seasoning. It's a dry seasoning or dry condiment, and it's just the best.
I
should be more articulate about it, but if you've tried it before, then you guys know what we're talking about. It's pretty easy to find, and it also, a lot of these sauces themselves derive from plant matter, right? So we're using plants on plants on plants, and I don't know, this plan to domesticate plants was cartoonishly successful. You know what I mean? The stuff you can buy in a grocery store or at your local market, odds are it did not naturally occur in your part of the world. You know what I mean?
Well, it's very likely that the animals that eat that stuff that you also enjoy eating weren't in your part of the world. But hey, by some magic, we all decided these animals taste good and they like to eat these things. And now we're all happy and Benihana's is a thing.
Mm-hmm. Only these arbitrarily chosen animals are cool to eat.
Yeah.
only this list. And we have domesticated them such that we can determine their lives that way, right? That's why the most widespread non-human large animals are livestock animals.
Exactly. And we will make as much corn as you need. In fact, we will make 280% more corn than you and those animals need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we'll figure out what to do with the corn later.
Yeah.
We'll figure out maybe a syrup of some sort or a fuel. Imagine. Check out our episode. What was it? How corn took over America or something. Yeah. And look, folks, ancient people. We always have to say this. Ancient people were just as smart or as not smart as anyone else alive today. So it should come as no surprise that civilizations in other parts of the planet quickly figured out the wild plants that would be suitable candidates for domestication. Like, of course, Eastern Asia, rice, you know, South America, potatoes, right? Tomatoes. It goes on and on and on. And parts of the African continent, of course. But plants weren't just domesticated as a food source, right?
Oh, no. Dude, plants do all kinds of things. I remember when we first learned about hemp on this show, and it was the first time I ever knew that hemp was used as a textile, a fiber that could be woven, and you could create all kinds of things with that stuff. You know, we domesticated sheep. One of the primary reasons, the stuff that grows on their backs can make some really great stuff called wool. You know, think about cotton, how just important cotton as a textile and plant was for the United States and other countries around the world. Really bad past, right? But it was massively important, and it still is.
Yeah, even before the invention of things like the cotton gin, when it was very, very labor intensive to gather cotton, it was such a useful crop that society built itself around it. And I love too that you're pointing out sheep, because I got to tell you, man, have you ever spent time with sheep?
Yeah. Oh, man, me and sheep, we go way back.
You go way back? Yeah.
We go way back.
Oh. Yes. No pun left behind. I feel bad, man, because, you know, if you have worked in, I guess, the sheep industry or spent time with sheep. Tell me if I'm incorrect. Maybe I just met a bad sample size, but sheep are kind of dumb.
Well, it's weird because if you compare them to goats, there's definitely a different vibe.
Right. I'm just thinking goats have always struck me as kind of the unhinged relatives of sheep.
Yeah, I've met a few goats. My son and I went to a thing. I won't go into a long story, but my son and I went to the Cumming Fair, C-U-M-M-I-N-G Fair in that place. It's in Georgia. It's a town. And there was this one goat, dude. This one goat was off his rocker. I don't know what happened to him. His eyes were funny. And he would just jump up at you and just make full eye contact with you. Just like, I don't know. He was a human in a very recent past life.
They do have distinct personalities, right? Llamas are also famous or infamous for this. It reminds me behind the scenes of one of the most excellent recent horror films, The Witch. Apparently, the most nightmarish cast member was the goat playing Black Phillip. He was like Gary Busey level unhinged.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I always think about that when I see a goat. I'm like, you might be cool now, but I don't know what's gonna set you off, man.
That's exciting.
It is. It is very strange because maybe we're also anthropomorphizing. Maybe we're sticking human framework upon a non-human animal, and maybe we've done something similar with plants, which we'll get to. One of the most beautiful things, if you're an extraterrestrial or so-called artificial intelligence, you meet humans for the first time, you say, tell me about your whole thing with plants, then you might be surprised and find it a little poetic that people also domesticate plants for no material use, just because they're beautiful and people like beautiful things. Like, you're not going to see somebody cooking with tulips on the regular or wearing a tulip clothing. You're going to see them planting them and looking at them.
Well, it's true, but you can also make those things very useful if you've domesticated bees, let's say. You're trying to produce honey or something, right? So in a way, even the things that we just kind of take as beautiful and things to behold do have a pretty unique and interesting purpose. Sometimes, not always.
I agree with that. I think that's a really good point too, man. I love that one because it shows us that this domestication isn't as siloed as we may want to imagine it to be, right? To bees. So this domestication, it's not a going process. Somebody doesn't just find corn and then like move the resource as though they're playing a Sims game. They start selectively breeding this. Every staple crop that you eat is genetically modified. The question is whether it happened recently or whether it happened thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago.
Oh yeah. The way I would think about it, Ben, is maybe it's gradual GMO or rapid GMO.
There we go. Yeah, there we go. And, you know, it's crazy because the early human cultures, they encouraged the growth of what we would see as positive traits, defined as things that are useful to people. More edible parts of the plant, fewer non-edible parts, more resistance to temperature, right? Or to lack of water, et cetera, et cetera. And humans wanted these things. By gum, they got them. Right now, we got deep on this, but right now, people still aren't sure how many different types of plants exist. But if you go to experts like Michael D. Perugonon, then you'll see there are thousands of plants, like, well, around 2,500 that are considered to be semi or fully domesticated. And some of them are very old, date back to the Neolithic. Some of them just got domesticated within the past few centuries.
I wish I had an example to be like, looking at you, whatever.
Looking at you, Tamako.
Oh, there we go. There we go.
That would be done, right?
I think so. And you know, something that's strange to think about here is that the Earth has been around for a long time and plants have been growing and getting obliterated over all, you know, over all of those millions and millions and millions of years. It's weird to think that we're in a, I guess, and what is it called? The Anthropocene? No, that's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where we're in. Like, we have very specific plants that have only been around for a couple thousand years, tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, right. Because there had to be humans to domesticate the things, right? And humans are still a relatively new fad in Earth's history. I think that's an excellent point. I think we also need to point out that domestication of plants started to become more and more of a focus of early human civilization. You would be less nomadic because now you had a compelling reason to stick around in the same place because you had to actually make sure the crops grew. And we're not saying plants made people lazy. They ushered in this still not totally understood explosion of new techniques and technologies and processes. People were still hunting and gathering and migrating, and people still do that today, but now they were doing it with a level of food security that simply could not exist ever in human history before agriculture. And, you know, like looking at it now, it feels, with the benefit of retrospect, that we can be a bit condescending about it. And we can say, oh yeah, sure, I would have figured it out. I would have done that. But how did they figure this out? How on earth did this bonkers plan actually work? To answer that, we got to look at a pretty strange, it's called a non-human conspiracy. What if there's a different explanation? What if the whole time, folks, plants were cultivating us? And please, folks, just so you know, our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccan, did insert a squeal from a plant. Plants can squeal. It's just not for it's not in the range of human hearing.
It's ultrasonic squeals.
That is the level of sound design you get with this show.
Wow. Hey, we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Here's where it gets crazy. I don't know, man. What do you think about this? We talked about it a little bit off air, I think.
The concept that plants coaxed us into being domesticators. let's break it down a little bit. If we're saying plants potentially domesticated humans, does that mean the plants coaxed the humans to live where they were and to take care of them?
Domesticate me, right, is what they were saying. It's a good question, right? I mean, it seems that crop domestication is not what we were told. Many, you know, in most conventional classrooms, we're kind of taught that it's this one-way street.
Yeah.
That someone figured out domestication and humanity conquered nature. But I like what you're describing because it does feel more accurate. Maybe we could call it a weird interspecial group project.
Oh, under our relationship status, it just says it's complicated.
It's complicated. Yeah. It's open, but it's complicated.
Yeah.
We still hang out, you know.
Yeah.
So the idea here then is that plant species adapted, but they adapted in a kind of symbiosis, mutualism. It was better for some plants in some ways to have human fingers on the scale, right? Now we have these, all the stuff you just described earlier, a dramatically increased range, a ton of genetic advantages, you know, that simply didn't exist in the plant's predecessors. It's kind of super dope for the plants on the wide scale, on the evolutionary scale. It stinks for, you know, if you were thinking, does an individual plant have a soul or dreams or aspirations? Well, it stinks for that individual plant because its purpose is to be killed and consumed.
Yeah, that is weird. But if we could truly get into the perspective of corn, if corn somehow had an awareness of like a bunch of plants together, then corn, they've seen the world, man.
Mm-hmm.
Like without humans, they couldn't have done that.
No, they wouldn't even be the same plant. Right? It would be a hardy, inedible grass creature
that nobody would have been that interested in. And now they're like one of the hottest things on the planet.
They're so hot right now.
Huh.
Corn. So, the band and the food. And yeah, that's a really good point. You know, this has been a success story for plants. You can see similar arguments, this co-evolutionary symbiosis thing. You can see it when you look at the evolution of dogs and their relationship with human beings. Like, dogs have evolved eyebrow muscles to mimic human expressions. Dogs are one of the few non-human animals that understands the concept of pointing.
Yeah.
It's just nuts.
My dog even learned how to wink in like a weird kind of way. It's
weird.
Yeah? Trust me.
Can you describe it?
It's a dog that stares at you and then winks and then just waits for you to react. And depending on how you react, maybe it winks with the other eye and it just stares.
Yeah.
Meadow, I'm looking at you. Weirdo.
Did she wink?
No, she's asleep. She's probably dreaming.
Dreaming of winking. And there's a guy that has a pretty good perspective on this concept. His name is Ian Hoder. Ian Hoder is an archaeologist who has what some of us doubtlessly would consider a dream job for decades. He has been deep into the excavation of a little place called Catalhoyuk.
Oh, wait, that sounds really familiar to me. We've heard about this before. It's in Turkey, but I don't know anything else. Was it in Ancient Aliens or something? Is that why I'm getting flashbacks?
It recurs. We've mentioned it in several different episodes. It's a really weird place. It's like 9,000 something years old. There are huge questions about why people built something there, how long they lived there, what their day-to-day lives or spiritual beliefs were like. It will often pop up in ancient civilization stories, ancient alien stories, the true origin of humanity type stuff. And it's a fascinating place.
Well, and Hodor believes that this may be where, maybe not the origin first ever point, but Hodor believes it could have been one of the first places where some of this domestication was taking place.
Mm-hmm. And Hodor also doesn't cotton to the idea of, you know, humans as a civilized force taming the natural world. Instead, he calls the early interactions between humans and domesticated plants the, quote, first entanglement.
I don't know. I like the way that sounds. It just sounds a little naughty.
Some pop stars have influenced the way we look at the word entanglement now, right?
Yeah.
And you know who you are. Thanks for tuning in. We appreciate your support.
They're not listening.
They might be. So Hodor said, look, as plants became increasingly domesticated, humans became increasingly dependent upon those crops. And that meant they would do their absolute best to make sure crops survived to harvest and could be regrown, hopefully over a larger amount of territory the next year. But at the same time, you know, as the seasons tick on, our good friends, the plants, become increasingly reliant on humans. They got a little too comfortable.
Yeah. And isn't there a story about wheat kind of became so dependent on humans that it was difficult to find specific strains of it in the wild anymore? It was basically like, oh, that's the wheat that you got to grow on that specific soil that those humans got.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. This is a perfect example because multiple plants can no longer reproduce in their current form without human intervention. And it's kind of a fascinating thing, right? It reminds me of some fruits that have, you know, that have a pit, like picture, I don't know, like an avocado or something. Those things were reliant on dinosaurs to eat them and then transport them by passing them through their intestines as they, you know, walked and dinoed around.
Wow. It's given me flashes of human domestication when whatever the next thing comes along and decides that we're cute and worth keeping around.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
if only we could breed them to have bigger eyes and ears. Right.
Well, yeah. And they can't breed anymore unless we intervene and, you know, help out. But that's fine. If you need one, we've got specialized companies that provide, you know, pretty good humans, actually.
Pretty good. Make sure you get your humans from a certified human provider. Watch out for those kitty mills.
Oh, wow. That's exactly where my brain went to.
Yeah, right. That's what happens. But, okay, it's weird then because what Hodor and other experts are arguing is that domestication made humans and some plants codependent. They entered a codependent relationship. And now, again, to the point about entanglements, codependent carries its own not super great implications in modern English.
Well, of course not. Well, because if you've got a reliable source of, you know, wheat, barley, whatever, one of these plants that is a staple, right? You can have more people join up and hang out around where those crops are. Then now you really depend on those crops because if you don't have them, you can't feed all the people that are there. And if you're not making enough, you can't feed them. But you're also adding in the economics of the whole system where you're not only making that crop to feed all the people who now live there, you're making that crop to make money or whatever, to trade, right? To bring other things in that those people also need.
Yeah, Yeah, that's absolutely it. The system builds upon itself. We talked about this in the past, man, but remember that book Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari?
I have heard you talk about, I think Noel's read parts of it too. I've not read it, but it sounds amazing every time we talk about it.
It's a great think piece book. Now, a lot of scientists and subject matter experts get their dander up about certain passages, but Harari talks about this as well, this plant-human relationship. And he specifically says, the agricultural revolution was history's biggest fraud, and that wheat and rice and potatoes domesticated Homo sapiens rather than the other way around.
Sure, Harari. I still don't get it, but I mean, I kind of see the argument. I just don't understand how there's what actions were taken by the plants to domesticate the humans. That's what I want to know.
Yeah, same, right? And, you know, do check out the book. It is worth a read. You can also see new research that has been conducted, including a multi-university thing in Europe, where they're trying to prove, or maybe they're trying to address or support the suppositions of people like Harari. But I'm with you. I'm Team Matt on this. This takes us all the way to one of the strangest topics we've grappled with in the history of this show. To your question, what did plants do? We always think of plants as these passive creatures, right? Just encountering the world around them. But this idea, flipping the script here, it brings us to the sticky, complicated notion of something called plant intelligence. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, we have a video on this on our YouTube channel. Go and check it out.
Plant intelligence. Okay. At first, yeah, might sound pretty nuts. No pun left behind.
Well, it always makes me think about carnivorous plants for some reason. Ooh. I don't know why I associate the act of eating another creature, like a living creature, why that is somehow intelligent. But I know it's not. It's just that's what I think about.
It's one of the oldest covenants for sure. You know, also that's a creepy way to describe it, but I agree with
yep.
you. It's also, I mean, think about it too. When predators evolve, they tend to exercise what we would call a higher degree of intelligence than prey animals. So that transfers maybe to our image of a carnivorous plant. Also, Feed Me Seymour, Little Shop of Horrors, stem to stern banger, best song about dentist in the history of musical theater.
Dude, yes.
You remember that one?
Yeah, oh, I do. I definitely remember. But if there's something about, it's not planning that's necessary. Maybe it's just cunning that's necessary to hunt something successfully. And to be like a predator that's large enough to be successful enough to sustain itself for a long period of time, there, to me, it speaks to some kind of, as you're saying, intelligence, or at least I think the word is cunning for me.
And there's a convergent evolution too that we see in predators, right? Mm. That's where the eyes start to shift toward the front of the face. You know, you get different types of muscle, et cetera, muscle groups rather. I know we got to point out there are carnivorous plants that aren't necessarily go-getters the way that humans think about them, right? The ones that are just evil cups, basically.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, even, I don't know if it's the documentaries we've seen in the past, all of us together collectively, but like a Venus flytrap, when you learn about the system of those little, it's feelers, they're like hairs that are inside, right? And it's just a system where you trip it twice in a short time span, the thing closes and it waits, it digests and then opens again. It's a pretty simple system, but is there intelligence in there?
Yeah. Or is it cunning? How do we define intelligence and cunning? I think a lot of when we dismiss the idea of plant intelligence, check out our earlier episode on that. What the people who dismiss that are making an error. I would argue they're conflating two related yet distinct concepts, intelligence and sentience.
And let us explore it after a quick word from our sponsor.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases, and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
And we have returned. Shout out to all the plants tuning in to tonight's podcast. However you're hearing this, write us a plant email.
All right. Now that you've said that, I am going to find a way to take these headphones outside and play this episode for, I've got a rose bush, so I'll see what I can do.
That's awesome. And we do know that plants, there's this fascinating series of studies that show us plants do seem to react to music, to voices. But it's kind of like maybe a dog reacting to humans in some way. They may not be getting, you know, they may not be aware that you are playing Glenn Miller for them, but they may be reacting to some sort of note or vibration.
Yeah, man, those trombones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, big fans of trombones, plants. Oh, boy. This is why we got kicked out of botany class. Mm-hmm. Someone who would have agreed with us is an actual botanist, an Italian botanist named Stefano Mancuso. And Mancuso argues that humans have always dramatically underestimated what he sees as the intelligence of plants, just because we're coming from the human perspective. You know what I mean?
Yes. And Mancuso wrote a book titled The Incredible Journey of Plants. Oh, buddy. I love it. I love the idea. It's kind of what we're exploring here today. And he thinks that if we look at plants altogether, or a plant outside of what he calls the animal filter, then there are other qualities, like their mind-blowing qualities will emerge. But, you know, you've got to take your brain out of that whole, like, this is a plant and this is an animal. Animals run and bark and meow and they're great. This plant sits and grows. Okay, you got to take yourself away from that differentiation, I guess.
Yeah, and then when you do that, you see all these strange actions that plants take. You know, the seeds that hitchhike, the adaptations that plants have evolved to spread themselves are nothing short of astonishing. Like, what's the name for those seeds that spin when you throw them here in the air?
Helicopter seeds.
Helicopter seeds, you heard it here first.
I don't know what they're called.
There's something called the dynamite tree, the Hura crepitans, that can shoot fruit capsules up over 300 feet away.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that in slow motion in one of them nature documentaries.
And plants can thrive after man-made disasters like the nuclear meltdown at Chernobyl. And then plants also can basically nap for thousands of years. They can just go dormant. And then you give them the water, you give them the soil, and they're just right back at it.
Yeah, man, just like viruses in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm. Or the Siberian permafrost. Yeah.
We're fine.
And look, at this point, you know, rightly, with some validity, we might collectively groan and say, come on, guys, come on, Matt, and the one they call Ben, adaptation does not necessarily imply intelligence. Evolution is a brute force hack. Evolution occurred before humans were a thing. It's not as if any of these plant life forms woke up one evening and decided to mutate. Is it? Because the tricky thing is, to understand that, we would have to have, humanity would have to have a definition of intelligence, like a good one. And humanity does not, right?
Yeah. Well, humanity's version of intelligence or definition of intelligence is like, you're good at being. Not really. That's not really it. But it's close to that, isn't it?
Yeah. It depends on what school of thought we subscribe to. Like, multipolar intelligence would say there are discrete genres of good at being, right? You are good at numbers being. You are good at interpersonal relationship being, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of educational systems are based off those distinctions. But if we look at the most basic operative definition, I think we could say intelligence can be defined as the ability to operate successfully in a given environment, which means you might be very, very smart in one scenario and very, very dumb in another one.
Oh, so like you can't successfully put together that bathroom vanity that you just bought or the sink that you're supposed to put into it. Wait, no, hold on. I'm just being self-deprecating. I can't do that stuff. So I'm not intelligent in the putting together vanity sets arena.
You know, it's the differences that define us all, right? I think I would be in the same remedial vanity set class, because there's a trick to it, you know. Also, like, yeah, to that example, let's say you're a physics professor and you take an entry level physics midterm that kids take in undergrad. You're going to ace it because you teach it. You're very intelligent in that world of physics. But then let's see if you can get together with other physicists and successfully install and hang a door.
Yeah. I bet they could.
It's so tough. It's so tough. This is not us dunking on physicists. This is us saying it's so tough to make a door work right.
Yeah. You got to get a lot of things correct. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. And so in that hypothetical situation, we see the same entity being considered very, very intelligent, and then maybe not as intelligent, depending upon the changes of their environment. And then if we remove the animal filter Mancuso's talking about, then we see that plants are another type of life form or collections of life forms behaving in a pretty fascinating, dare we say, intelligent manner. Like you said, plants travel the world. You know what I mean? I don't care how many stamps are on your passport. There is a plant that has been more places than you.
You're probably right.
It's a weird observation.
It is. And it's also weird to think about a specific plant, because there are some trees, right, that are much older than the oldest human being.
Mm,
mm-hmm. But it's one tree, right? It's not that type of sequoia or whatever. It's I don't know. In my mind, I don't see how individual plants can then have enough experience to learn, I guess, to be intelligent in environments, right? To then take actions, because then it always goes back to the action. What is actually being done? But, you know, think about the evolution of some plants that like taste horrible or have or are toxic to predators or anything mm-hmm. that would eat them, right? Mm-hmm. That's something.
Yeah. And then maybe I like where we're going with this. Maybe it points out the weakness in some of these arguments is the idea of a distinction between a group and an individual. Does, you know, a single stalk of corn sprout from the ground like a hand sprouting from a grave in a horror movie and say to the universe, I, corn, not all corn, just the one that is me.
I corn.
Coming to you soon from Apple.
But yeah, because how do you transfer that information? Let's say a single stalk of corn gets played Mozart over and over and over again until the day that it passes away. But it's alone in a chamber where it's growing. Does that corn transfer that information in any way? Even if you take the seeds mm-hmm. or, you know, that you take that corn to make more corn, is mm-hmm. there epigenetics involved with this thing?
Right. Do you, like, if you took that one of those Mozart kernels and you planted it in another field of corn, would the other corn be like, this nerd, right?
Yeah, but then you play Mozart to the entire field, and that one piece of corn is like, I don't know, nodding its head of corn?
It's vibing.
I don't know.
I mean, it's a good question. We know that plants do have these very specific adaptations, right? You mentioned stuff like capsaicin or various toxins. Plants can also respond to attacks. Like there are some sweet potatoes that when they are bitten or chewed or attacked by some kind of creature, they release chemical signals that make other nearby plants spread defensive proteins that make them tougher to eat. So plants do, in a way, talk to each other. They just they do it through complex chemical signals that human scientists still don't understand. That gets very close to sounding a little like intelligence, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a crazy move, by the way. Oh, I'm being eaten. All y'all get really hard, so he won't want to eat more of us.
Everybody,
some of us will survive.
Hit the gym.
Yeah, no, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. It is. It's crazy because it has been occurring far before humanity hit the scene, right? Mm-hmm. So this anthropocentrism might be stymieing some of our progress. Like at the far end of the spectrum, I still remember our episode on plant communication. I don't know about you, Matt, but I don't think either of us were expecting it to go as far as it did. Like I didn't know they talked to each other.
Yeah, no, it's very different. The chemical signals always goes back to that movie, The Happening, I think, from M. Night Shyamalan. But it's worth a watch at some point to
it's
imagine.
Not perfect.
Just imagine that plants somehow developed a simultaneous defense mechanism against humans. That's fascinating to me. It's a cool thought experiment. You have to go through Mark Wahlberg saying every line. Like he's whispering it just a little bit, but it's okay. You can get through it. Fascinating idea.
The idea is amazing.
Yeah. I lost myself because now I've just got visions of Mark Wahlberg whispering his lines.
You're saying there's something wrong with the plants?
Say hello to your mother for me.
Say hello to your mother for me.
How you doing, chicken?
I promise I'm not racist anymore. Right. But I walked down the street for that one. But
I really like him as an actor, by the way. If for some reason, yeah, that movie with him whispering, just, I don't know why it bothered me.
Well, also, that was a directorial choice. So can't put it entirely on him, right? But there's something else that I wasn't aware of that Mancuso points out. You could say that plants act a bit like parents in some cases, because to your point about very old, mature trees that have, you know, burst through the forest canopy and now they form, you know, the top echelons of it. Some of these trees will feed the saplings that can't get sunlight, and they'll feed them through underground fungal networks.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy logistics, right?
That can't happen, is what my brain says.
Right. And then our brains could also say, okay, we get it, guys. That's all fascinating. But these plants didn't decide to do any of that. It just happened. And I would argue that that points out, even though it's a safe, understandable position, it points out a flawed assumption in the argument. Do humans decide to do things?
No.
To what degree does, you know, free will, man? Does free will exist? I'd like to think so.
Well, according to Robert Sapolsky, which is a person you should search right now through your Googles or whatever other search you're using, he doesn't think free will exists. And he's been studying it for a long time.
So he didn't even decide to write his book. Right?
It was going to happen, dude.
Yeah. Now, refresh us on that. He is a neuroscientist, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I don't have all the facts. I was reading about him in October. He was making the rounds for one reason or another. People were talking about him a lot. And it was just fascinating to, again, and it's worth your time, I think, everybody out there, just really consider free will for a little bit. Because the act of considering free will feels like a free will thing, right? But it may not be. Maybe if you hear me say that and then you have a desire to think about free will, maybe that was just a part of who you were anyway. And you were just going to listen to this podcast, this episode specifically, because that's just who you are, man.
Well, it's true, right? It's a thing that most people would kind of look at askance, right? If someone says free will doesn't exist, then there's this, for most people, I think there's this impulsive, instantaneous reaction that says, no, me, I'm a thing. I am the master. I am a thinking entity. Yeah. You are an object in space. You are a voice in the dark. That is very different. I decide what I do. Right. But we also know with just the barest, like, street level hustler psychology that people can be easily pushed into not just making decisions, but feeling as though they have made not just doing actions, I should say, but made to feel as though those actions were their own decision. It's deep water.
It is weird to think that your starting build, once you enter the game, mm-hmm. right? It's just, that's what's going to happen now, depending on the starting builds of all the people around you.
Right. And it doesn't sound fair. It certainly doesn't sound egalitarian. And it's also like a question of, you know, that's where you get into the fuzzy line between science and metaphysics and philosophy, right? Like, were the Calvinists correct when they argued predetermination or determinism, et cetera? Like, are in that argument or in similar arguments of that note, the story goes that when you are born, you are either destined for hell or you're destined for heaven. And nothing you do in any direction will change that initial conclusion. Kind of depressing, right? I don't think anybody wants to imagine themselves as a series of if-thens, yes-nos, that cannot change their mind or determine their own course in the universe.
It's certainly not helpful for decision-making.
Right. And by the way, arguing against free will not hold up if you were ever in court. Your Honor, we're just all sort of objects in space, man.
I do like that idea. I'd love to see that. Has that been, I wonder if that's been in a movie before. Write to us and let us know, because I can imagine that's a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Matt, maybe here we end with a few more questions than any answers. Like, what would this teach us? Did plants conspire to use humans as another vector in evolution? I mean, can we even attribute motivation to them?
Maybe we can. The mycelial network thing somehow holds a key to be able to transfer nutrients and potentially information across long distances between very different genetic, maybe cousins of like the same plants. That is very interesting to me, and I think there needs to be a harder look at that. I'd love to take one, although I would understand 5% of what's being said. I'm definitely interested in that.
It, you know, that reminds me, we should also mention plants squeal. Like, we weren't just joking about the sound effect. Plants do vocalize toward one another. And to your point about this communication, this networking, I wonder how domestication has changed that. Like, cruciferous vegetables are all kind of related, to your point about cousins, right? Broccoli, bok choy, cabbage, etc. So how does their interaction work? Are they far enough apart now that they are mutually unintelligible in a chemical way? What about different citrus fruits? You know what I mean? People are crossbreeding those all the time. What about apples? Apples are so weird. Those things are all mutants. It is so hard to grow apples.
Yeah. Just go with the Honeycrisp. Wait, that's like a brand now, isn't it?
Well, aren't they all? I mean, they are distinct types of apple, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. That's just the one my son likes.
Yeah, I go for Fuji. But I think the most misleading one is Red Delicious.
It never was, not even once.
They promised a lot. They promised a lot. And did they deliver? Well, to each their own. I mean, it also depends on our perspective, right? Like, you're listening to this, and we could dismiss all of this, all these highfalutin dialogues about the nature of free will and intelligence, vis sentience, etc. And you might say, well, you know what, guys? I don't see plants out at the farmer's market buying parts of people. You might be
not
correct.
Yet.
Not yet. But we can't get around it. The domestication of plants changed humanity just as much as humans changed plants, only in different ways. But the degree of change is still, I think, significant and quite, I don't want to say terrifying, but tune in to our space fungus episode.
Yeah, I think the fungus is the way to go, man, because fungus eats people, right? I think that's an important aspect. I guess some plants also eats people.
It's true. Sorry. I mean, fungus can also change behavior.
Yeah, there's something to it. We mentioned that before, that if you look at the food chain is a little different, and it continues along. There's no top of the food chain. It's just one big circular thing. Fungus is like sitting pretty, looking at everything going, delicious.
Mm-hmm. Fungus is like that producer that you might not hear on the songs, but when you look through the liner notes, fungus is on every track of the album.
How's she on here too?
So I guess maybe one of the takeaways we could say is this does teach us about the dangers of framing, the dangers of anthropocentrism. Maybe by limiting ourselves to these human or fauna perspectives, we're limiting our understanding of the world overall. To your point about the food chain, I mean, is that, I don't know, man. We didn't get to answers. I don't know what the answers are.
Well, just because one person or a group of very smart people, at least conventionally to us humans, has the idea maybe plants domesticated humans, it doesn't mean it's true. But I think one of the most important things here is what you just said, Ben, to put your mind in a place like that, to ask questions that are pretty out there like that, just to consider not only yourself, but all of the things that you do every day, including enjoying that piece of bok choy.
Ah, and what better way to end, right? Now that we've talked about the nature of intelligence and existence with plants, let's go eat some. Let's just chop them up.
I'm so hungry.
It's what they would want. We can't wait to hear what you think, folks. Again, like we said, this is a more philosophical conversation, right? And we would love for you to be a part of it. So let's call it free will. And find us. We're on the internet. We're on YouTube, Instagram, Farmers Only, you name it, you'll find us or some iteration thereof. And if you don't sip the social meds, if you're like, hey, guys, I'm a plant, I'm a quaking aspen, I don't get on TikTok, that's not for me.
Ah, well, then find us on Conifers Only specifically. That's right. That's the one. But yeah, maybe you like to use a phone and call numbers and then leave voicemails. Well, you can do that with us. Call 1-833-STDWYTK. When you call in, you've got 3 minutes. Give yourself a cool nickname and let us know if we can use your name and message on one of our listener mail episodes. If you don't want to do that, why not instead send us a good old-fashioned email? We are
the folks who read every single email we get. Can't wait to hear from you. Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.